Oh man.
How embarrassing was that for us?
Oh my God, was it embarrassing?
Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff.
Hello, $500,000. The Raiders are going to beat the Jets, right?
Was that a question for me?
Kind of.
Is it mono Sam Darnold or is it regular Sam
Darnold? That's a good question. The Jets, here's the thing. Raiders are favored by 3, but they're on the road. And even though the Raiders are 6-4 having a good season, they've only won once on the road this year. Unless you count London as a road game, then they've won 2 games away from Oakland. But Jets aren't very good. And if you look at the Jets this year, there is a path. There is a blueprint for how the Jets could beat the Raiders. And it's because of their run defense. If you look at the Jets on offense, they're 32nd in DVOA in passing offense. So they're dead last in the NFL in efficiency in the passing game. They're 29th in rushing offense. Like, they're brutal on the offensive side of the football. They're 21st in pass defense, which is like, okay, not the worst in the league. But they're 2nd best in DVOA against the run, the 2nd most efficient run defense in the NFL. They rank number 1 in stuff rate. They get more stops at or behind the line of scrimmage than any other NFL team. 34% of opponent carries have been hit for 0 or negative yards against the Jets this year. That is a remarkably high number. The NFL average is 19%. And the Jets have done it on 34% of opponent carries this year. The Raiders, for example, on offense, are 5th best in the league at not allowing plays to go for 0 or negative yards in the run game. It happens 15% of the time against the Raiders. So 34% to 15% is a massive difference. And that, to me, that's the area that the Jets can win this game, because the Raiders offense, if you knock them off schedule more than usual, there's a good chance the offense struggles. And we've seen that the last couple of weeks. The offense, it hasn't been completely knocked off schedule, but the offense has been off schedule a little bit the last 2 weeks. And they scored 17 points on the Bengals. The offense was really only responsible for 16 of the points they scored against the Chargers. So even if the Jets don't get 34% of the Raiders' carries in the backfield, if 25% of the carries that Josh Jacobs gets are hit at the line of scrimmage or behind the line of scrimmage for a loss, that's going to throw the Raiders' offense off, and it might be enough to keep them from actually putting up a significant amount of points. We talked about yesterday with Hunter Renfrow being a great slot receiver. He's great if it's 3rd and 5. If it's 3rd and 11, I don't know how much Hunter Renfrow is giving you. And Derek Carr is kind of the same way as a quarterback. Honestly, the offense is just built that way, that when it's 3rd and more than 5, it might be a little bit of a struggle. So if 1st down, Josh Jacobs gets hit for a 1-yard loss, now the Raiders need some explosive plays to start making up for those types of first down carries, and they haven't shown that they can do that. So that's probably the biggest key to the game. The Raiders have had a top 5 offensive line this season. The Jets have been the best in terms of getting in the backfield against the run in the NFL. That's the matchup that probably determines this game. If the Raiders' offensive line is able to push around the Jets a little bit and Josh Jacobs is never getting hit in the backfield, the Raiders should have no problem winning this game. But if again, you see the first couple of drives and Josh Jacobs is getting hit in the backfield, even if he's breaking tackles and picking up 2 yards, if he's getting hit in the backfield, having to make guys miss in the backfield, it probably is going to be a long day for this offense, because that means the offensive line isn't winning as well as it has been this year, and the Jets are doing what the Jets have actually done well all season. Now, the Raiders, they're still going to win the game, right? Like, it's... the Jets aren't as bad as the Bengals, but I think it's going to kind of be like last week where, okay, even if the Raiders' offense does get off schedule, they're still going to beat the Jets. Like, they're 32nd in pass offense and 29th in run offense. Like, what are they good at? They're 31st in sack rate allowed. Like, they give up sacks. Max Crosby's going to have 4 again. Like, it's just, I don't know. I expect the Raiders to win because the Jets are incompetent, but there is a path. Unlike last week, there was no path for the Bengals to win. The way the Raiders played last week was, here, Bengals, you guys could win this game. And nope, they could not do it. They physically could not do it.
They were incapable.
There was no chance it was happening. This week, it is possible. This week, it's possible. But I still don't see it happening. I guess I guess maybe it comes down to, like, the Jets' run defense is very good. The Raiders are only going to put up, like, 17 points because of it. I guess then it comes down to Sam Darnold, because, like, the last 2 weeks, Darnold's completed 63% of his passes, and he's 5-1, touchdown to interception. But we also had Sam Darnold throw 5 picks over a 2-game stretch earlier this year against the Patriots and Jaguars. So I guess if you get the last 2 weeks of Sam Darnold, maybe that's enough. A decent Sam Darnold and a really good run defense, that might be enough to beat the Raiders. But even still, you're going to lose by, what, 2 points in that scenario? Like, it's still like the Raiders are still going to have a chance to win the game, even in that. Like, that's the worst case scenario to me, is the Raiders are losing by 7 in the fourth quarter. Like, that's as bad as I think it can get.
I'm just trying to figure out what wide receiver is healthy for the Jets. Is Robbie Anderson healthy?
I don't know.
Yeah, that's sort of like half the time I'm just like, is he healthy?
Because if
he's
healthy,
well, he had a 90 yard touchdown this year
against the Cowboys, right? That was when they beat the Cowboys.
Yeah, so I could see that.
The Jets have over 20 guys on their injury report.
Oh my god,
that's a lot.
Like, their injury.
Robbie Anderson's not on here, though. So okay. Demaryius Thomas is, but limited practice, so he'll probably play. So, yeah, this is a very long injury. The Raiders have, like, 5 guys on their injury report. The Jets have, like, 20-something.
They could field an injured team?
Yeah, I guess, like, 7 of these guys were in full practice yesterday, so we can say they're down to, like, 15 on the injury report.
That's still a... They could play 7-on-7 with their injured guys. All right.
Yeah, it'd be great. So, the Raiders are going to win. Like, the Jets aren't good, but it's plausible. It's plausible. Now, one thing we've seen the last couple of weeks from the Raiders, they have picked up 10 sacks in the last 2 weeks. Max Crosby had 4 in one game, which is remarkable. But I don't think that sack rate is anywhere near sustainable. The Raiders, for the season now, have jumped up to 13th in the league in sack rate. They're just above average, NFL average, sack rate, which is terrific. Last year, they were last by far in sack rate. This is a team that doesn't have a dominant edge rusher. Their first-round pick that's an edge rusher has been struggling. It's basically been a few spare parts and a fourth-round pick and Max Crosby being very good, and they're 13th best in sack rate. But the last 2 weeks, it's 10 sacks against the Chargers and Bengals. And the edge rushers have looked competent. They've looked more than competent. They've looked good. But the Raiders, it's not sustainable, because despite the 10 sacks the last 2 weeks, the Raiders are still just 28th in the NFL in pressure rate this season. Like, they're still not getting... They have a high rate of sacks to pressures right now that's not very sustainable. And if you look the last 2 weeks, the Chargers had 2 backup tackles playing, and the Bengals have just the worst offensive line in the NFL. So the opponents the last 2 weeks have been a big reason why they've gotten the 10 sacks. But on the sort of sack rate to pressures, last 2 weeks they have 16 quarterback pressures. 10 of those have ended in sacks. The first 8 games of the year, they had 59 quarterback pressures. Only 15 ended in sacks. So the first 8 games of the season, 25% of their quarterback pressures were sacks. The last 2 weeks, it's 63%. That's not going to be sustainable. And if you look at just the pressures, which is hitting the quarterback, knocking the quarterback down, hurrying the quarterback, or actually getting a sack. Over the first 8 games, they got 7.3 pressures per game. The last 2, they've gotten 8 per game. So the amount of quarterback pressures is not increased very much. It's gone up by 0.7 per game recently. But the amount of times they've converted those to sacks has gone up. So it's like the opposite of Arden Key, where Arden Key, every time he'd get a quarterback pressure, but he's not actually going to bring it down. Now, all of a sudden, every time they get to the quarterback, it's ending in a sack. That's not going to continue, more than likely. You're not going to keep getting... Every time you get close to the quarterback, it ends in a sack. Now, rest of the season, though, they don't play some great offensive lines. This week, the Jets, again, 31st in sack rate allowed. Like, they're not stopping very much in terms of getting to the quarterback. Later on, they'll play the Titans. They're dead last in sack rate allowed, 32nd. The Broncos to end the year, 28th. So they play 3 of the worst teams at protecting the quarterback the rest of the way. Kansas City in 2 weeks is 5th best, so that might not be great. Jacksonville and the Chargers are both around average, assuming the Chargers actually have some health on their offensive line. So you should expect some regression, but the Jets this week, the Titans and the Broncos might give the Raiders a few more big sack games. But overall, the good trend for the Raiders defensive line is that they're not last.
All right.
Like, that's it. Like, last year, they were terrible. Like, last year, they traded Khalil Mack.
Over that bar.
Last year, they traded Khalil Mack and then finished last in the NFL in sack rate. And not even close. Like, they, by far, the worst team. They could have doubled their sack total and still would have been last in the NFL in sack rate. So, this year, they may not be getting a ton of pressure, right? They're still in the bottom five in the NFL in quarterback pressures, but they're actually making some plays in the backfield, which is something they didn't even come close to doing last year. So, to me, it's like, if they were... Here's the thing. If they had a legitimate edge rusher, this defense would be so much better. Like, if it, in all seriousness, if they had Khalil Mack, the defense would be probably a passable average NFL defense, because now all of a sudden, Khalil Mack's getting double-teamed, and every single play, Max Crosby doesn't get double-teamed. Or Cleveland Furrell doesn't get double teamed, or Benson Mayoa doesn't get double teamed. So, like, if they had a legitimate edge rusher, I think this defense is significantly better. Granted, you don't have the cap space and the first round picks that you got for Khalil Mack, but I think that would have made a big difference if they had a legitimate edge rusher. Like, had Cleveland Furrell worked out as a legitimate edge rusher, that would be a significant improvement to this defense.
So, looking at Football Outsiders, their middle and guard, so their center and guard,
the Jets,
the Jets are ranked 29th. So,
just blitz up the middle.
That's kind of what
here's the thing: the Raiders actually they have like the third lowest blitz rate in the NFL. Yeah, third lowest blitz rate in the NFL this year. They don't blitz.
Okay, well, maybe it's time to. Well, I. Jonathan Abram was supposed to be the blitzing safety, right?
Well, he and Carl Joseph are the same player.
Okay, well then...
They didn't blitz with Carl Joseph either. Like, Paul Gunther just is like, oh, we're not blitzing.
I'm too afraid.
Pretty much. That's kind of what it is. Like, hey, we're going to drop people into coverage. Yeah, we'll be fine. Yeah, go get him. Go get him, Cleveland. It's like, they don't blitz, so maybe they should, or maybe it's a big day inside. Like, is Jonathan Hankins going to get a sack?
That's sort of...
Is Maurice Hurst coming up the middle for a sack?
If I had to read the tea leaves, somebody is coming up the middle and dropping Mono Boy.
That'd be good. I mean, if you get anything from the interior guys as far as a sack goes, that's like, holy hell. Incredible.
It's going to be... They move Cleveland Furrell inside.
Oh, that's a good point.
He's going to be left unblocked.
That's a good point. He's just... Cleveland Furrell's going to have three sacks, and we're going to look back, and they're like... They didn't block him on any of them. He was confused. He just ran straight to Darnold and was like...
He didn't even tackle him. He just sort of walked up, picked him up, and then set him down and was like, was there a whistle?
Was there a false start? Man, Cleveland Furrell getting three sacks, all of them straight up the middle. If that happens, it's not Cleveland Furrell, it's the Jets. It's the Jets. Totally correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming. Make sure you place your bets at the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Every Monday night, Bourbon Street Lounge will host football viewing parties with giveaways, including jerseys. It is technically correct. Brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
Check out the podcast on lvsportsnetwork.com.
Visit the Orleans Casino Race and Sportsbook all season long. Football enthusiasts can catch this year's games with a Monday night viewing party at Bourbon Street Lounge, with giveaways throughout the game, including jerseys. Plus, you can play Las Vegas' longest-running free football contest with $30,000 in guaranteed cash prizes each week. Or place your bets from your phone or tablet with the Be Connected Sports app. Download it at BeConnectedSports.com. Boyd Gaming has you covered for football season.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants.
No, I don't want to go to a party in your pants.
Bischoff's Briefs.
Underpants!
Bischoff's Briefs.
Very well.
UNLV hosts San Jose State on Saturday.
1 p.m. game. You can hear it here on ESPN Las Vegas. Watch it on AT&T Sportsnet. Last game at Sam Boyd Stadium. More than likely, there is very little hope for UNLV here. It is still San Jose State.
I was going to say, doesn't the Las Vegas Bowl... It's not the last game. It's the last game.
UNLV game.
Okay.
Who cares about the Las Vegas Bowl when it's UNLV football?
I thought we were called technically correct.
That is true. That is true. Thank you. I appreciate that correction. I will say it is San Jose State. They are, even though San Jose State's having a good year for San Jose State, they're still only 4-6. So it's not like this is a great team that comes in here.
Gotta win this one to get bowl eligible.
That's true. San Jose State does not run the ball well. They're second worst in the conference in yards per carry. And they are average to below average defensively, both against the run and the pass. So not worst in the conference like usual, but still not exactly good. The main difference for this year's San Jose State team is they can throw all over teams. They are top five in the Mountain West in passer rating, yards per game, yards per attempt, and touchdown to interception ratios. Josh Love, their quarterback, is the leading passer in the Mountain West and number two in yards per attempt. They like to take shots down the field. For 4.5 years of the Tony Sanchez era, I would have said this is a big problem for UNLV because they can't defend the pass. They hadn't been able to do it for 4.5 years. Can't generate pressure. Can't make plays in the secondary. But they just stopped Hawaii. Hawaii's offense scored 14 points in that game. Hawaii had to bench their quarterback after the first quarter because he was not good at all. Threw an arm punt. Should have thrown 3 picks in the first quarter as a team. And UNLV did it by dropping 7 or 8 guys into coverage on almost every single snap and just forcing Hawaii to throw into tight windows. So maybe that works again?
Except how does the – I'm trying to figure out a way to phrase this and keep it positive, but what does UNLV's offense
do? They have 2 wins. There's nothing positive about it. What does UNLV's offense do? Nothing? I mean, San Jose State's defense isn't good, but, like, UNLV's offense was atrocious last week.
I know.
Like Oblatt and
they
Charles
were negative
Williams.
Seven.
Oblatt, no, they were even.
Oh, yeah, fair.
Oblatt and Charles Williams.
Technically correct.
Have to be better. Like, they have to be better. Kenyon Oblatt had a brutal game last week, and the running game was pretty much non-existent. Well, actually, Chad Magyar had a decent game. Charles Williams running the ball was pretty non-existent. So, like, it's hard for them to win this game simply because I don't believe in the offense, and I still think they're going to give up points and yards through the air, even though they were pretty good against Hawaii. But there's a chance it is San Jose State. I don't have much confidence in them.
Yeah. Oof.
They're wearing black jerseys, though.
Ooh.
Wiz Cambage was ejected from a Team Australia game last week.
The Aces center is playing for Australia against Japan in a pre-Olympic match. Cambage had already been given 1 technical foul in the game. She hit a turnaround jumper in the fourth quarter and then motioned about 1 or 2 away from the ref's face that it should have been an and one. And the ref teed her up and she was ejected because it was her 2nd technical foul. By the way, Aces were down by 4 with 7 minutes and 20 seconds. Team Australia was down by 4 with 7 minutes and 20 seconds left. Japan ended the game on an 18-9 run after Cambage was ejected.
All right, so the key to beating the Australian national team is get her,
yes,
get her teed up early.
But Lauren Jackson, who is the head of women's basketball in Australia, she had a quote she gave to ESPN, and she said,
"You're not going to do an Australian accent, are you?"
She said, "I get it. I know it's frustrating, and it's never going to change. So she's just going to have to suck it up."
Oh, man.
So imagine you're playing basketball for your country, and the head of your country's federation says, yeah, you just got to suck it up.
Yeah, they're not going to give you that foul. You're bigger than everyone.
Cambage responded on Twitter with, "Or we can send refs that actually have experience reffing talent who aren't biased or intimidated." Now, the play that Liz Cambage complained about and got her 2nd technical foul on, she wasn't fouled.
No, she was
not. She had very little ground to complain about that foul call. And she absolutely deserved a technical foul because she was about 2 feet away and motioned for an and one in the ref's face. Like 100%, like taunting the referee, deserves a technical foul. Everything else Liz Cambage puts up with, she might have a valid point. But we just saw during the WNBA regular season her yell about the referees because they weren't letting the post players show off their skill, that they weren't giving enough calls to the post players in the paint. And in the story that ESPN wrote, they summed up Liz Cambage like this. She was removed from the Commonwealth Games final in 2018. Cambage has also had disciplinary issues in both the WNBL and the WNBA. In her 2017-18 WNBL stint with the Melbourne Boomers, she was ejected from a couple of games and given a one-match suspension for unduly rough play. In the 2018 WNBA season, she drew 7 technical fouls. So Liz Cambage, whether she's playing in the Australian Professional League, the WNBA, or internationally for Team Australia, always has problems with referees. Maybe it's not the refs.
I mean, yeah. Lights FC will hold open tryouts in January.
January 11th at Cashman Field. You got to pay $25. Should I go play goalie?
I think we need Clay, we need Ed, we need me, we need you, we need Chapman, we need whichever member of Cofield and Company, probably Ari, that they're willing to send. We all need to try out.
They will definitely take our money.
Yes, I know for a fact they will.
There's no doubt they will take our money. I will say this. Unfortunately, the tryout's on a Saturday, because I would love to do is do our show from the net of their tryout and just do a show while people are trying to make Lights FC. They might actually score some goals, though, unlike the team. But my one fear in, like, trying to do something funny with this is, like, these are people paying money to try to, like, have a soccer professional career, and I don't want to be out there and, like, I screw up somebody's chance. Like, I would actually kind of feel bad about that.
See, and I'm thinking the opposite. How bad would it be if it's like, yeah, our new starting wings are Tyler Bischoff and Chris Chapman?
I can't run that long. I can play goalie for like one drill, but that's about it. So we'll see. We'll have to figure out what we can do. They might have a new owner by then, and they might not even like us anymore.
How do you not like us?
Nobody else likes us.
The Chicago Bears have the 14th worst record in the NFL.
The Raiders own the Bears' first-round pick. Field Yates this morning tweeted out every first-round pick that's been traded and where it currently stands. How the hell is the Bears' pick only 14th? Like, they seem like a train wreck.
Let me tell you a little story about a team called the Cincinnati Bengals.
How is it only 14th? Like, they're terrible, and they're only picking 14th. There's so many bad, like, every league is like, what are we doing about tanking? The NFL doesn't have a tanking problem. They just have, we have crappy teams.
Yeah, there's no parity.
It's terrible.
In the league that legislates parity.
That's not true. There's a lot of parity for these crappy teams because only one game separates 5th from 14th right now in the NFL draft. So they can move up quickly. Problem for the Bears, though, is they have a strong strength of schedule, and that is the tiebreaker, but in the opposite way. Like, the worse your strength of schedule is, the higher your pick is. So if the Bears end up tied with teams, they're probably going to lose the tiebreaker and have a lower pick to give to the Raiders. So actually, I want to do this with you quickly here. Predict for me win-loss record win rest of the way for the Bears. They're home against the Giants this week.
That's who's have they benched Trubisky?
I don't. He's been practicing, so I assume Matt Nagy said he's their starter if he's healthy, and he's been practicing in full. So, Trubisky.
Tie.
All right, that's going to make this difficult. All right, at Detroit.
Loss.
All right, so that you have them at 4-7-1 at the moment. Home against the Cowboys.
Loss.
4-8-1. At Green Bay.
Loss.
4-9-1. Kansas City at home.
Loss.
4-10-1 at the Vikings to end the year.
Have the Vikings already clinched the wild card?
I did. Probably, right?
Maybe a win then.
So you have them at 5-10-1. So
the Arizona Cardinals. They will have basically the same record as the Arizona Cardinals.
So last year, going 6-10 got you picks 9, 10, and 11. So 5-10-1 gets you pick 8.
That's not bad.
Yeah, that's. I think if that
that's
pick
a wide
gets in the
receiver.
Top 10, if that pick gets you in the top 10, that's pretty good.
Which wide receiver is it?
Well, the problem is like two wide receivers going to go in the top 5 this year.
I know. So you're getting like the third guy.
Yeah, which so like Alabama's third wide receiver basically.
MLS Commissioner Don Garber says 32 teams will happen.
Major League Soccer is expanding to 30. Sacramento was just given the 29th franchise. Charlotte is the front runner to get team number 30, but that has not been announced. If you're Las Vegas, kind of hoping that Charlotte falls apart in the next couple of months and you can swoop in and be team number 30. But Inside World Football is a quote from Don Garber where he said, 32 teams will happen at some point, but it's not happening anytime soon. Right now, if Major League Soccer said they were going to 32 teams, Charlotte, favored to get number 30, Las Vegas is probably next in line to be number 31 or 32. But that's right now. Like, that's the very near future. For Don Garber to say it's not happening anytime soon, that probably isn't great news for Las Vegas, because if it's another 5 years before they add 31 and 32, Vegas could be completely out of the running for Major League Soccer, or there could just simply be two other cities that come in with better presentations or better pitches. Like, I don't know, the whole timing of this might end up screwing Las Vegas.
I know I've asked this before, but there are only 20 teams in the English Premier League.
Yes.
Why is 32 such a, like,
money?
I understand that.
They get money when teams come into the league.
But the Premier League has 20 teams, and they seem to be doing fine on money. So that's the part that's confusing to me, is it feels like you're devaluing your product by overexpanding.
Yeah, they're not the Premier League. A better comparison is the NHL.
Okay. Do that comparison for me.
You get $550 million when a team enters the NHL as an expansion franchise.
And that's better than having 28 good teams.
No league has ever cared about, hey, let's have fewer teams to have better teams.
All right.
They want more teams so more people will give them money.
All right. I'm wrong.
They also have a second division with promotion and relegation in England.
I know. I'm in favor of that.
It's not going to happen here.
I'm in favor of that in the NFL.
That doesn't work. I don't even want to hear it. Texas Tech is really, really mad at UNLV. It's kind of amazing.
You're listening to Technically Correct with Tyler Bischoff, brought to you by Boyd Gaming.
If you pop 30, pop 30. Popping dirty.
Pop 30?
Yeah. Oh, he popped
like
dirty.
That. We gotta start using that more. Pop dirty.
It means you tested positive.
Tyler Bischoff is...
No, it's fun. I like this phrase. Pop dirty. I'm gonna start using this in everything. Lexington Thomas is gonna pop off a dirty run.
Technically correct.
Texas Tech and UNLV is the greatest rivalry to never have been played. Joel Tomboy transferred from UNLV to Texas Tech in the offseason. It was not until yesterday that the NCAA finally ruled on his eligibility for this season, and they denied his waiver. Joel Tomboy will not be eligible to play for Texas Tech this season.
Why did it take so long?
I don't know, because it's the NCAA and they're dumb.
They know the season already started,
yes,
right?
He's been playing for, like, what, 3 weeks now?
Yeah.
It's ridiculous. But they are not going to let Joel Tomboy play this year. So the final outcome for UNLV's transfers: Trey Woodbury, granted a waiver to play this year at Utah Valley. Ben Coupette, playing at Little Rock this year. Tervell Beck, playing at Kent State. I can't remember. I'm sorry. Somebody tweeted that at me after I said I couldn't remember where he went. Thank you, person, that I can't remember your name. Louis Bongai is at Grand Canyon.
He's the one.
He is. And he played in like two or three games so far this year. Jonathan Chamwechachua is sitting out at Baylor. And now Joel Tomboy was not given immediate eligibility at Texas Tech. So, yesterday this news breaks that he is not going to be able to play this year. Chris Level of RedRaidersports.com tweeted, UNLV wouldn't cooperate, but shouldn't have mattered. A shame. NCAA hands out waivers like Halloween candy, but not here for some reason. Technically correct, can report. I did actual journalism yesterday. UNLV was fully cooperative in Joel Tomboy's waiver process, like they were with all other players that left the basketball program. They did not hold this up. They did not do anything to screw Joel Tomboy, despite Chris Level reporting that and every single Texas Tech fan on the planet thinking that UNLV somehow screwed Texas Tech here. Which, by the way, I don't understand. Like, what do Texas Tech fans think UNLV did?
They, like, sent... We will not release his transcripts.
Right. Like, I mean, I guess technically they could have done that, but then the NCAA would have been like, what the hell are you guys doing? You have to give us the transfer. Like, I don't understand what Texas Tech fans think UNLV did or why they think UNLV had power over this situation. The NCAA makes the decision. I don't understand why they think UNLV had power. Now, what happened? The reason behind this, or more than likely the reason behind this, the NCAA updated their transfer guidelines this year specifically for situations like this, when a coach leaves or gets fired and players leave the program. The NCAA, when that happens and a player asks for a waiver to play right away because, hey, my coach got fired or my coach left, the NCAA asks the previous school. So the NCAA asks UNLV in this scenario for a statement that basically sums up that player's transfer situation. Like, was the kid dismissed from the team? Is one of the questions. Is the kid in good academic standings? Is something they want to know. But the key difference between Joel Tomboy and the rest of the UNLV transfers is this. The rest of the UNLV transfers did not have the opportunity to come back to UNLV. They went into the transfer portal, and TJ Altzelberger basically said, bye.
He didn't want Nunu?
Joel Tomboy went into the transfer portal, and TJ Altzelberger said, we want you back too. Like, we will take you back. There is a scholarship for you if you want to come back to UNLV. That is a specific guideline that the NCAA asks about. Did this kid have an opportunity to come back to his school after his coach left or was fired? And I can't say with 100% certainty if all of the other transfers didn't have the opportunity or did have the opportunity, but we can make the assumption they did not.
They didn't want Louis?
I do know 100%. Joel Tomboy had the opportunity to come back to UNLV. So, when the NCAA is reviewing this, what they see is effectively Ben Coupet was run out of UNLV, right? He did not have the opportunity to come back to UNLV, so the only chance for him to play college basketball this year was somewhere else. So he's granted immediate eligibility. But they see Joel Tomboy and they see, huh, he could have stayed at UNLV, so he chose to leave by himself. Like, it was his decision to leave. He could be playing basketball at UNLV this year. Denied, he has to sit out a year. That's the difference. I think it's a bunch of crap. Like, Joel Tomboy should absolutely be eligible.
He came here for family, and now we have a different dynamic.
That's a good joke. I think it's crap. He should absolutely be eligible to play right now. But that's the difference. That's why he's not able to play this year, because basically UNLV was like, hey, he's good. We want him back if he wants to come back. But he didn't. So the NCAA is like, all right, you could have gone back and played there. Whereas with Ben Coupet or Turvo Beck, they're like, bye.
So if you want to be a really, really mean coach, and like, if you're the new coach, you could literally just say all the kids who are in the transfer portal, yeah, we wanted them back. And it's just they all get...
That's the other thing, is the NCAA, they don't make their decision based solely off of what the previous school says. Like, that's simply one piece of information they take into account. They're not making their decisions solely based on UNLV saying, hey, he could have had a scholarship. Like, so, I don't understand what Texas Tech's fans think UNLV's role in this was. Like, they think UNLV had some veto power over Joel Tomboy, and they didn't. All they said was, yeah, he's good at basketball. We wanted him back if he was willing to come back.
He's tall, and if we could eliminate the long twos, we really think we got something
there. Like, they wanted that player back, and he didn't want to come back, which he shouldn't. And he should absolutely be eligible to play this year, but that's the difference in Ben Coupet, Tervell Beck, Trey Woodbury, and Louis Bongai. Well, hell, Louis Bongai didn't have a scholarship. I don't even think... Louis Bongai didn't have a scholarship, and I don't think he played last year. If you don't have a scholarship and didn't play, like, imagine that guy getting told, nope, you can't transfer.
Just like, I walked on.
They're going to give me a scholarship there. What? Like, that would be ridiculous. But, like, Joel Tomboy, that's why the scenario's different. Now, I am absolutely in favor of Texas Tech fans being mad at UNLV. Because UNLV fans already hate Texas Tech and Chris Beard. I'm so glad we have some reciprocated hate at the moment. My God, schedule each other already.
Yes.
I want a home and home, but both games are in the same season. Like, you
can
play
you
them
do
twice.
That?
Yeah, you can do that. New Mexico and New Mexico State do it every year. Go to Lubbock and have them come back to Las Vegas.
It is time for a new rivalry.
It is. It's the best rivalry that's never been played.
What was the last rivalry? The civil conflict?
Oh, UConn and
UCF?
UCF, yeah, that's right.
We need a new one.
They're still going to... That still happens, right? The civil conflict hasn't gone away, has it?
I don't know. All I know is that the trophy got left on the field one time.
And every time Central Florida goes to UConn, it's snowing. They're like, I've never seen this before.
What is this magical white precipitation?
Are you ready for a slow game on Saturday for UNLV?
Basketball?
Yes.
Am I ready?
SMU ranks 308th in tempo. So this will be 6 out of 7 opponents for UNLV that are in the bottom 100 in tempo this year.
Get in touch with the show on Twitter at @Bischoff_Tyler. Tyler Bischoff is...
dumbest smart person I have ever met in my life.
Technically correct.
Is pay your markers a good chant? That good heckling?
Very Vegas specific.
Yeah, so the Golden Knights fans chanted that at Evander Kane last night because the Cosmopolitan alleges they gave him $500,000 in credit and he never paid it back. I think it is great because it is simple and hyper-specific to Evander Kane and him not paying his markers. The only potential problem I really have with it is, do enough people know what markers are in this context? I'd never heard that phrase in the context of gambling until I moved here.
It's
had no idea what it was.
Uber Vegas specific.
Yeah, and like even now, it's like I've heard it like 3 times before, so it's not even like it's something that's that common. So that's the only thing, is there's a chance Evander Kane heard it and was like, what the hell are they talking about? Markers.
Maybe that's why he didn't pay.
He's like, what's a marker? Cool.
It's like, I didn't buy $500,000 worth of markers.
What do you guys think I have, kids?
Yeah, like what?
Ridiculous.
This is crazy.
So that's the only thing. We ended up getting 4 chants last night. Normally, we only get like 1 from the Golden Knights fans. Go Knights, go. But we got go Knights, go. Pay your markers. Refs, you suck. Note after they got a call right. And... and...
he's the worst.
And... Kane, you suck. So, 4 chants. Not all of them the most creative, but we got 4. We got more variety than usual. I like it. I would love to see more of that. Unfortunately, they don't play the Sharks quite enough. I will say, there wasn't enough heckling. Like, the first period, the fans did pretty good, but after that, it sort of died off. Like, they weren't really heckling Evander Kane very much after the first period. I think some of that is the way the game went, and that the Golden Knights, like, they didn't score, they didn't do a whole lot. Like, they tied the game at 1, and that was pretty much the only moment of the game, but that was it. Like, they didn't really do a whole lot to get the crowd into it last night, so I think that had a lot to do with it. Like, had Evander Kane gotten lit up a couple of times, he got hit once or twice, but had he gotten lit up a couple of times in the second and third period, it might have come out again, but there weren't any really, like, important moments in the game to get the crowd into it.
I just enjoyed there was an intermission report where Stormy talked to Ryan Reeves and he corrected her on how many hits he had in the game.
Oh, really? What happened?
She basically was like, wow, you had 21 hits. And he went, actually, 23. And she was just like, okay. And he's like, yeah, you got to pay attention to that stuff.
Interesting. He had 12 in the game, so I know it wasn't 21, point taken. So... Ryan Reeves actually got the 3rd star of the game last night simply for hitting people.
That's fair. It's what you pay him to do.
That's. I mean, the Golden Knights lost. There was only 1 goal scored. So it's like, all right, there's not like a lot of people to give it to. But they gave it to Ryan Reeves simply because he hit a lot of people. Now, point I made earlier this week. End of regulation of a tie game sucks in hockey. Golden Knights and Sharks last night were tied for the final 10 minutes. Over the last 5 minutes of that game, there were 6 total shot attempts between the 2 teams. Not shots on goal, 6 total shot attempts. For the first 55 minutes of the game, there was a shot attempt every 30 seconds. In the final 5 minutes of the game, there was a shot attempt every 50 seconds. Almost twice as often in the first 55 minutes. That's absurd. A tie game in the final 5 minutes should be the most exciting time in your sport. It should be doubling the amount of shot attempts, not cutting it in half. But hockey sucks when it's tied in the final 5 minutes because the teams stop trying to win games. And instead, they play for overtime because they know they get a point.
If one team is playing for overtime, doesn't that sort of dictate that the other team also has to then start playing for overtime?
I mean, a little bit. You can kind of kill the game off if you just skate around with the puck and don't do anything really dangerous. Yes.
Or like set up like 5 guys in your zone and just be like, all right, cool, yeah, try it.
But the NHL, like, it sucks. The NHL needs to fix it. Like, that's brutal, the way that game ended in regulation. Now, overtime was fun. And we had a stretch of overtime where Nate Schmidt and William Karlsson had an odd man rush against the Sharks. Both of them ended up getting a shot on goal. Neither one of them scored, obviously. And it led to a Kevin LeBanc breakaway for the Sharks. He also did not score. And then Nate Schmidt made a good outlet pass to Karlsson for a breakaway, who, again, did not score. Here's what it sounded like in Spanish.
No puede llegar el robo. Ya llega Karlsson a poner orden por el centro del ring. Ahí pierde el puck. Y el equipo de Vegas Golden Knights lo recupera. Se arranca. Este es Nate Smith. Lo tiene Nate. Y se arranca Nate. Disparo. ¡A dónde! ¡A dónde!
¡Wow! ¡Doble!
Y ahora es el equipo de San José que se viene a cerrarle a Fleury. ¡Fleury grande!
Duelo de porteros, señores. Emocionante.
¡Mira Caso! ¡Caso! ¡Disparo!
¡Otra vez a Rondel!
¡Qué emoción, señores! En este tiempo extra que hace por
un duelo completo
increíble,
de porteros.
Increíble.
Arondel y Fleury.
What did you think Herbert Castro said?
Potato.
Yeah.
He did not.
Said portero, which is Spanish for goalie. Although I wish it was potato now. I wish Marc-Andre Fleury's position in Spanish was potato. That would be significantly better.
I feel just shame. I took 5 years of Spanish.
Did they teach you goalie?
No, I don't speak a word of Spanish.
Yeah, it's okay. Potato would be better. Would be much better if the Spanish word for goalie was potato. The Golden Knights this year, they've now gone into overtime 6 times. They have won twice via shootout and lost 4 times in overtime. So they have not scored a goal in overtime this year. They are one of 3 teams in the NHL that have not scored an overtime goal, a.k.a. won a game in overtime this season. The others are Vancouver, Boston, and Vegas. All right, well, Vegas is one of them. Vancouver and Boston are the others. I was reading straight from the notes there. Not good.
great radio. Buddy.
Yes. The Golden Knights, though, of those 3 are the only one that have lost 4 times this year. So they're the worst team in overtime in the NHL so far this season. The analytics behind it aren't great either. It's a small sample size with just 6 overtime periods, and it's 3-on-3, so it's a little weird if you're looking at analytics for it. But Corsi in overtime, 44%. So they only have 44% of the shots in their overtimes this year. Expected goals percentage, 39% in overtime this year for the Golden Knights. So they're not good. The strange thing, though, is you kind of think they would be good. Like, if you just look at the forwards they have to use in overtime, William Karlsson, Riley Smith, and Mark Stone are all high level on both ends of the ice. Like, all 3 of those guys should be excellent overtime options. And then Max Pacioretty, Jonathan Marchessault, Paul Stastny, Alex Tuck, like, those are all very good second tier forwards to choose from for an overtime shootout. So it seems like they should be good. I guess you could say defensively they're not super deep for an overtime period. Like, Nate Schmidt and Shea Theodore are good, and then John Merrill is your next best option. But it still feels like they've got the players to be good at 3-on-3, and they're just not. They just haven't been good at it at all. Like, they haven't gotten the results, and the analytics underneath it aren't good either. So I don't know. Still cheering for the shootout. They still can't get that far. Get back to the shootout so Malcolm Subban can get in here. Think UNLV wins on Saturday either of their games?
SMU.
Wow. I think that's the one UNLV fans would take, right?
Yeah.
Are you sure? I mean, the basketball season doesn't matter.
It matters to me.
Yeah, that's nice. What's their combined attendance going to be? Are they going to get 30,000 between the two?
Did you just admit to listening to Tyler's show?